All right, good morning, everyone. How y'all doing? So I just have one small question. Do we have any Astros fans in the building? That's pretty impressive. Okay. Any Dodgers fans? Well, raise your hand, bold Dodgers fans. Stand up. That's awesome. Well, good morning and welcome. I am Michelle Hare. I am with State Farm's marketing department, and it is my pleasure to serve as today's MC for Using Setbacks to Build Resilience and Succeed. State Farm is honored to be a returning partner of the Texas Conference for Women, and we are thrilled to bring you our Starting Today exhibit. How many folks have been to the exhibit already? Are you shy? Raise your hand high. Yes. So we want everyone starting today to think about your financial goals. When you go to our booth, write your goals down on this little doodad here and place it on our dream tower. And you may be one of our lucky winners at the end of the day. So stay tuned for that. So, and also let me remark about the magnets here. Everyone has a magnet on their chair. So starting today, I will what? You're going to write that down, place it in a prominent place at home in your office so you always remember your goals and keep them right in front of you as well. Plus, you're 42% more likely to bring your goals to fruition if you just start by writing them down. So make sure you visit the exhibit, and we want you to remember that your friends at State Farm are here with you every step of the way. We want to ensure life goes right for you, and we want to ensure all of your financial dreams come to fruition. Is that a deal? Yeah. All right, very good. So with that being said, let's ponder, what happens when life doesn't go right? When you're faced with divorce, bankruptcy, a layoff, a child not living the life you envision for them? How many of you have read or heard the affirmation, there is no such thing as failure, only lessons? Yes? So Thomas Edison said, quote, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. So then I ask, is it possible to find freedom in what didn't work? Can we fully call something a failure if it made you stronger than you were before, more capable of managing your finances, more confident in relationships? Failure is only failure if we become paralyzed and allow ourselves to fester in a self-created mire of shame and self-doubt. Our capacity to use failure is what builds our greatest successes. So today, we will hear compelling stories of disappointments and triumphs. And most importantly, we will receive tools and strategies to move beyond fear and aggressively move toward our victory. And to lead us through today's session is Jessica Leahy, a wife, a mom, an attorney, a teacher, and an author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Jessica, are you ready to take over?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Come on up.
I'm getting older, so I'm going to take off my old lady glasses that I need to read these so that I can see you people. Good morning. I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for coming today. We have a really, really great panel I'm so excited about. But my job here is to sort of to open the floodgates of about talking about failure, talking about setbacks, and talking about how to benefit from the wreckage that can happen when we really crash and burn in a spectacular way. I have done that a lot. I find it really interesting that, so I've had a lot of different lives. I've been a teacher, and I have been for almost 20 years. I've been an attorney for a very short period of time because I figured out the teaching thing was more fun. I have been a speechwriter for a governor. I've just done all kinds of cool things. along the way, and I've accumulated all these great stories. So when Gift of Failure came out, and inevitably the stories started coming in of, so tell us about your failures. I was like, oh yeah, I got the best story. I had this great story. It had to do with law school and not taking the practice exams and getting a 68 on my civil procedure exam. And it was a great, it was a good story. But the secret was is that I actually had a better story. And for a long time, I didn't tell anyone that story. My husband knew the story, my agent knew the story, and my editor knew the story, and I think my best friend and podcasting partner knew the story, and that was it. Mainly because I couldn't tell it without really wanting to vomit. It took me years to be able to tell this story without wanting to vomit. And what has happened, I've noticed, is that the more I tell it, the easier it becomes. And every time I tell it, I get emails and I get letters and I get all these comments from people saying, thank you for telling that story. But the interesting thing was that the first place I told that story was to my students. So I teach drug and alcohol addicted kids in an inpatient rehab. I can't teach full-time because I'm on the road so much as a speaker, so I teach part-time and I teach these kids who are challenging and maddening and wonderful and incredible, and I love them so much. And within the safety of that room, we try to write. We try to write about all the stuff that we're not allowed to let out other places. And so it's only fair if I tell them about the stuff that we're not able to let out other places. And so they were asking me about, they hate editing. Students, those of you who are teachers know that what people would like to do, what kids would like to do is to just write final drafts as their first draft. You know, just have it flow like honey from the pen. And they hate editing. They hate getting feedback. They do that like deer in the headlights, kind of go to their happy place and disassociate while you say the constructive things about their writing, and then they hand in the same paper again in a different color ink. So hearing feedback is one of the things I talk about a lot with my students. I say, look, the only way you can get better is if you hear negative feedback. And negative feedback makes them angry and makes them defensive and makes them sad and makes them not like themselves. And since this is the conference for women, I want to share a little bit of the research on failure and critical feedback and women and girls. And the reality is, and I'll direct you to the research of Girls Leadership. Rachel Simmons in particular is one of my favorite people over there. And she has a new book coming out this next year called Good Enough As She Is. And it's so good. But Lisa and I sat down and she sort of did a data dump for me on all of the research in girls and failure. And she also wrote this lovely piece for Time on Gift of Failure when it came out. And she said, okay, great. Yeah, let kids fail. But here, first you need to know this about girls. Girls handle failure a little bit differently than boys do. Girls internalize the failure as I am the failure. Boys, it's a little easier for them to say, oh, I screwed up that thing over there. That thing was a failure over there, but I'm cool. Girls tend to say, I failed. I am a failure. I am not perfect. I am less than. And so how we deal with that, especially as a teacher, that's important for me to know. I also, the other thing I know about girls is that they're really interested, the research shows, in pleasing their evaluator. They're very interested in, and their evaluator, hello, I'm their teacher. So they're very interested in pleasing me, and they won't often tell me when they don't know the answer to something. There's this hiding the failure, lying about the failure, pretending it's not there, denying it. And any of you who have read Tim Harford's Adapt know that the way we are successful in the end when we have failures is to have a positive adaptive reaction to failure, which is not to deny it, not to blame it on someone else, but to say, okay, I did that. Tell me how to be better. I'm going to listen. I urge you all to buy Celeste Headlee's book down in the bookstore about how to actually have meaningful listening and talking, how to have meaningful conversations, because so much of listening is about actually hearing critical things about yourself that are hard to hear. I mean, and I know for myself, and this is a universal thing from what I hear every time I talk about it, is that, you know, I don't read the comments when I'm a journalist. I've been writing for I wrote for the New York Times for 3 years. I've been writing for the Atlantic for almost six. Don't read the comments. Because what'll happen is there could be 100 great, glowing, wonderful, thank you so much for writing this. And then there's one, and I suck. I mean, clearly, that piece was a failure. I failed to plan ahead for some of the criticism that would come back at me. And then I start writing to the to my critics. And you can't do that. You can't work in defensive mode. You can't write, especially in a way that's sort of pushing off any criticism you will get. So that's why when I write now, I keep a few books nearby by women with really strong, declarative, active voices. So when I'm feeling weak, when I'm feeling like I need to hedge, when I'm feeling like I need to quote someone else just to show that I really know I was right, I pull those books out and I say, I need to sound more like these women that I admire that aren't afraid to say these things and just let it sit there. Okay, I've been hedging. Here's my story. So when I wrote, I'm not allowed to say I got lucky because I get smacked across the face by my podcast partner, KJ Delantonio, who used to be my New York Times editor. My agent gets a little peeved and my editor gets a lot peeved. I'm not allowed to say I got lucky, but I got so lucky. I had been writing about education for a while. I got noticed by some people who got noticed and told some other people, and my education writing got going. And I was writing for The Atlantic, and I was writing for The New York Times, and I wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Why Parents Need to Let Their Children Fail that went viral. And, you know, dream scenario. I started, the article went live on a Tuesday. I was doing national media by Thursday. I started getting calls from publishers saying, yeah, this is a book. And I'm like, yeah, this is a book. And so I finally signed with a whole other story, but I finally signed with my agent who had rejected me 4 times over 10 years. But I knew I wanted to work with her. I knew we were a good match. And I think she suspected we would eventually work together too. It was just going to be a matter of finding the right thing. So I've signed with the Dream Editor, and we have a 3-day auction with 14 publishers. And it's crazy. And in Publishers Weekend, Publishers Weekly, they wrote the word feeding frenzy. I mean, it was good. So I started writing the book. I also set too quick of a deadline. That was a nightmare. Don't do that. And so I wrote the book, and I got it done. I got it done the day before my deadline, and I handed it in, and then I waited and got pissed like 24 hours later when she hadn't gotten back to me on my entire manuscript. And then I got a phone call from my editor, and she is a grand dame of publishing in New York at HarperCollins, Harper Books. And I got a phone call, and she said, yeah, you need to come to New York. We need to have a meeting. She said it that way, too, which we all know what that means, right? But there was a little part of me was like, okay, this is going to be good. She's going to say, this is great. I had this fantasy that like, oh, no edits. It's so good. And I got there and she sat down and she said, yeah, so your book is unpublishable. That's not the worst part. Wait, it gets better. Your book is unpublishable and I think we need to bring in a ghost. Yeah. For those of you not familiar with the term, a ghost is a ghostwriter. Ghostwriter doesn't have to appear anywhere in my book. It can be a big fat secret. By the way, when you read books by celebrities, they probably had a ghost, and it's probably not on the book. It's probably buried in the acknowledgments somewhere, so this could be a big secret. I can preserve the illusion that I did this, and it was all fine. So I have a choice to make. I have 3 choices. I have vomit and curl up on her floor in the fetal position, which I did not do, which right there, big win. Number 2, I can say, okay, yeah, because she was very clear. She said, look, your writing is good, but a lot of journalists have this problem where they write a string of articles and that don't hang together in any sort of way. You're used to writing in 800 to 1200 word chunks. And so really, this is just about organization. So at that point, it's not sounding that bad, right? I can just have a consultant that they're going to pay for to help me with my organization. Or I could say no, and I could say please, and I could beg, and I could say, just give me the feedback, all of it, all of the feedback, the really ugly feedback about how I can do this better. 90 minutes to 2 hours, somewhere in there. I don't know. I started hallucinating at a certain point. I'm not sure how long. But a whole book, a whole Moleskine notebook, one of the thin ones, I filled with all of the negative feedback. She went through that whole thing and ripped it apart and told me everything I was doing wrong, stuff that I know not to do wrong, that I tell my students not to do. And I said, please, give me 2 chapters. Well, the other problem was we had already figured out that there's no way this book can be edited in time for my pub date, so we're already moving the book by a year. And I had had a head injury in the interim and couldn't write or read, so that was another small problem. But I was fine. It was 4 months later. I was fine. So the book's being moved by a year. So we have the time, and I say, look, and by the way, at that moment, I thought getting bumped by a year is already the biggest disaster in my entire life. And my husband, I would be doing something in the kitchen, and my husband would just look at me with that look of like, are you okay? And when he would give me that look, I would start to cry. Because no, I was not okay. And all I needed to make me less okay was to hear for 2 hours how terrible of a writer I was. But I listened, and I took it in. And I went home. She gave me 2 chapters to fix. She said, you can have these 2 chapters, but after that, if they're not shaping up, we're going to bring in the ghost. And I said, okay, 2 chapters. And I worked my guts out. But first, before I even started to work, I had to read all of that feedback. And I had to internalize what a terrible job I had done on the first book, but why? What of this wreckage of this book do I have to get rid of? The answer is almost all of it. And what can I bring forward with me? What's working? And that's the thing that I'm constantly telling my students they have to be able to do, is to hear when people tell you how to be better and take that forward with you and let the other stuff go. Let it go. Because this stuff is valuable. This stuff is valuable, but it's only valuable back there. This stuff is valuable with you as you go. Carry only the good stuff forward with you. And carrying that good stuff forward with me, book came out when it finally came out a year after it was supposed to come out, New York Times bestseller, and it's now in its 10th printing. And this book is my education in writing a book. And so the book I'm working on now hopefully will go a little easier. Hopefully will be a lot easier. But I would never be able to do what I'm doing now. This book wouldn't be what it is without my editor. Oh, my gosh, Gail Winston. I bow down to her every moment. But if I hadn't heard that negative feedback. And as I said, every time I tell this story, it becomes more my story about who I am. And in the same way that I would never, ever want to eradicate the memories of that first love that I eventually broke up with because he was horrible to me, but that made me who I am. This book, this experience is something that made me who I am as a writer. I'm a much better writer for it. I'm a much more marketable writer for it. I'm a better teacher for it. I'm better all the way around for it. So take those stories that make you want to vomit and tell them. Because somebody needs to hear them. It may just be my students. It may be writers in the room. It may be a friend. But those stories, those are the stories of who we have become. And they are not something to be hidden. They are something to be proud of. And that's what our panel today is about. So I'd like to introduce our panelists today, because they are a rocking group of women, and I'm so excited I can hardly stand it. I'd like to introduce Lisa Stone. Some of you may know Lisa from Blog Her. She is a founder, come on up, and former CEO of Blog Her. She is now the CMO.
Good morning.
Of Elvest. Come on
Thanks,
up.
Jeff. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody.
I'd like to bring up Kelly Hopping. Kelly is the Senior Director of Integrated Marketing at Rackspace. Woo-hoo! And Sarah Robohagen, who is the CEO of Flywheel. She has a very...
That was a fail.
Don't worry, there are no cameras in the room at all. Nobody saw that. One of the things I've asked these brilliant and amazing and successful women to do is to share a brief story of one of their own failures so that we can all benefit from it while I move the podium so that I can see the people over there. Just moving it a tiny bit. Don't worry, I won't break anything. Hopefully. Lisa, will you start us off? Because
sure.
Your story's
awesome.
I'm going
to break this down for you in 3 sentences. In 1997, I left traditional journalism and my marriage in the same financial quarter with my one-year-old baby boy on my hip. Mm. A lot of this was unexpected, like all of it, except for the baby boy. And I don't blog or go into it too much because I really respect his relationship with his father, but I was diagnosed with PTSD. Wow. Mm. And I was a shy girl. I was not the person you see today. I had to figure out how to teach myself to not only do public speaking, but to stand up in front of a group of 10 people when I was so scared and shy that my face would shake. You've seen people talk where you're like, oh, that's, oh.
Oh, sweetie.
I want to hug
Bless
her.
Bless your heart.
Yeah. Bless her heart. Okay. Right. Exactly. That was me. Now, since then, the key critical thing was my baby brother. 6.5 years younger. There's 2 siblings between us. He sat me down and he was like, honey, I don't know what all this is. You're great at home around the Lazy Susan with all of us. We can't get a word in edgewise. Why do you have this issue? You have to solve it. You will never be able to support your son unless you fix it. You must fix it. And I'm sorry, everything that went down, you're going to be fine. Get on it. And he was right. And that baby is now being put through college by moi.
Oh, wow.
And thank you. And I can sit in front of you only slightly sweaty and nauseated. And I encourage all of you to force yourself to meet your fears and know that other women are for you there every second of the way. So, thank you, Lisa.
Yes, ma'am.
Kelly.
Well, mine was about, I don't know how many years ago, a long time ago, 13 years ago, I guess. I don't fail. Like I refuse to grow up to fail. Like I wasn't raised that way. I had high expectations. I'm an achiever. I do it well. I do what's expected of me. I don't disappoint people. I do exactly what's expected. And so I wasn't prepared to fail. And so I did exactly what you're supposed to. I went off to college, got my degree, you do exactly what you do in college, you find a good job, you find a husband, because heaven forbid you're going to find a husband anywhere except in college. Somehow in the South, we believe if you don't find in college, it's never going to happen. So you get married unbelievably early for some reason. And I was married for 5 years. And I grew up in a family where my parents, my mom's here today, have been married 50 years this year. So to me, marriage was forever. Marriage is forever. It is sacred. And divorce was never a part of my vocabulary, just like failure. It was not an option. And about 5 years in, my husband left. He had... why is my voice shaking? I don't know why my voice is shaking.
It's because you're sitting next to me, honey.
Bless my heart.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Lisa's
catching.
Off on me.
That's right.
So he left. He started having an affair. I was a student at the time. I was a grad student at Harvard, getting my MBA, and his ego couldn't take it. He was emasculated by a successful wife, and so he found someone who was less threatening, less intimidating. And so I, of course, personalized this as I failed. I failed my marriage. I let him down. And so, of course, I sought forgiveness. And I bestowed sort of forgiveness on him, committed to working on this, building out of this. But he was having nothing to do with that. And so I pursued sort of a route of working through this marriage, saving this marriage. Not even because I was now determined to spend my life with this guy, but because I was determined not to fail. And I was like, I'm going to save this marriage because I do not fail. Eventually, he didn't give me a choice. Paper showed up on my doorstep, and he left. And so I was 27 years old, living in New York City, completely clean slate, starting over. Didn't know anybody. Didn't even know how to be single. I mean, I got married like 2 months after I graduated from high school. I mean, from college, not high school. Don't go there. College. And so I had to rebuild. And what happens in that process is there was so much shame. I don't know why I had so much shame. He's the one who walked out, but I had carried that shame. And so, like, have you ever filled out an application? Like, single, married, widowed, divorced? I just checked the single. I mean, who checks the D-box? Like, I would never check the D-box. Like, why would I admit that I'm just single? I was just so ashamed of it. I didn't talk about it for 10 years. I didn't admit it to anybody. My friends, my coworkers, no one knew I'd ever been married. I was just single, 27 years old. But what I did do in that process was I thought, I'm not going to take responsibility for his behavior. I had to come to terms with that. He chose. It was choices he made. However, I can learn and I can notice what could I have done to be a better wife, right? Even if it wasn't my fault, how could I be a better wife? And I'll tell you today, I'm a damn good wife.
Yeah!
And secretly, I wouldn't endorse this, but just between us girls, everybody kind of needs a starter husband.
Oh.
Like, I'm just telling you, you got to work out the kinks. Work out the kinks on your starter husband.
I'll
and then
share that with my husband when I get home.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, one of the loves of my life ran off with a flight attendant, so I guess that counts, right?
Yeah.
grew up, never made the A-team in any sport, desperately wanted to be a professional athlete, didn't even make the A-team. I was fired twice in my 20s, almost deported from the United States, and I am responsible for the worst athlete campaign in the history of Nike, completely. So I'm done. That's it. I was saying today, I actually do think that when I die, my grave is going to say she failed. And I'm so proud of it. So that's it. Let's keep going.
I would like to point out that there is something interesting you've done with your LinkedIn profile.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. No, that's a good, because I want to get into the meat of this.
Right.
Stuff. So my LinkedIn profile, if you go take a look, Sarah Rob O'Hagan, I've actually listed all of my failures within each job I had, as well as the accomplishments, because, you know, here's the thing is, like, you and I share this passion for this topic, is when you go through life, like, trying to hide them and tuck them under the rug, you take away your confidence. So I'll give you an example. When I got fired the first time, when I nearly got deported, it was literally like they gave me a one-way ticket back to New Zealand, 1 week of severance. It's like, we don't want you in our company or our country. Like, it's pretty epic. But I do remember, what I will say is the first probably, you know, month was incredibly painful and probably not unlike what you went through. Like, I actually believe with failure, even though Silicon Valley is very into the whole, like, pivot. Hey, it was a pivot. I'm like, if you haven't really felt it and, like, really processed it, you're actually probably not getting the growth and learning out of it. And for me, going through that, and just like what you described, recognizing that I actually bought that on myself, I was super arrogant, ahead of my skis, I deserved what happened to me. And when you finally get to that place and you walk into an interview and you go, okay, here's what happened. No, I'm not going to pretend that I took a sabbatical. I got fired. You know, you say that in the next job interview. Here's why. And by the way, I'm not going to do that again. Instantly, the employer's like, okay, at least you know a little bit about yourself, you know? So that's why I'm a big believer on your LinkedIn profile. Just put it out there, because if you show what you didn't do well, then a future employer is like, wow, this person's really in touch with who they are, where they're not so good, where they need other people to support them, which makes them a great employee.
Well, and one of the things that's sort of the hip, cool thing to do now in teaching is to, when you plan your teaching, when you plan your lessons, to actually plan in room for kids to fail, because parents are so freaked out about, we need a little, like, crescent circle here.
Yeah, there we
go. Parents are so freaked out about the perfect scores that they're, they don't understand there is no room for failure, because every grade counts. Every grade, every point counts. So if the teachers now have to actually articulate, no, I'm building this into the curriculum, and let me give you the evidence for why this is important, and this is what I spend most of my time going around doing, is, you know, speaking about the fact that when people aren't able to hear feedback, when they're not able to internalize and actually let go of the things that didn't work and take forward the stuff that did work, they're not learning as well.
Totally.
And P.S., they also don't stay as intrinsically motivated to
totally.
Do things. So how we allow that to happen in education is we have to actually make a physical space for it, which is what you've done with your LinkedIn profile, is make a physical space for that failure, which is really amazing to me. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about how we can not only for ourselves leave the bad stuff behind, and how do you know what's the good stuff to take forward, but also how do we create a work environment that leaves space for that? And anyone can speak to that. I mean, you've worked, Blogger expanded so quickly and became big so quickly, and suddenly it's this, you know, went from this cute little girl blogging thing over here to this amazing, huge, you know, I think the industry sort of, you know, people looked at that and thought, oh, that's sweet. There's a place for women to write. That's really cute. And then it became this powerhouse. But how do you keep up with that growth and make room for failure when you have a lot of people looking at you very critically saying, is this going to work?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. So there's nothing like having been a traditional journalist, such as yourself, there's nothing like saying, telling traditional journalism that, you know, community source content can be just as good, if not better, and more relevant to the lives of the women who don't see themselves on your front pages anyway, right? So what was critical to that, we decided that we were going to bootstrap an initiative by making sure that we didn't create the sins of repetition that were so tempting. Mm-hmm. So in 2005, I was already being paid to blog by the LA Times, and I'd started a distributed blog network for law.com. My two co-founders, Lisa Camahort Page and Jory Desjardins, were both blogging professionally as well. And a writer at the Washington Monthly asked, where are the women who blog? And every woman blogging threw up her hands and started making lists of women who blog. And I was like, this is not helpful. No one's reading our list. They're putting the same four white guys on CNN saying, this is who blogs. And no one's listening to us, but we're reading each other, and we're massive. I had already built a company called Women.com as editor-in-chief with a bunch of Hearst magazines and a big distributed network, and I knew the sheer power of this. So what we did was we said, okay, we're not going to be the three mostly white women who hold a conference in our own image. Instead, we are going to invite other women online and say, would you like to help us show the answer to this question? We are going to create 50% of the panels at a conference, and we are going to do the other 50% by popular vote. So if you're interested in showing who's using this technology, then please come and contribute a panel idea. Popular vote will determine who shows what. And 4 months later, we had a sold-out conference. 305 women showed up from four continents, and we had panels on everything from mommy blogging, which no one had heard of at that time, to feminist hip-hop blogging, led by two experts in the space, including Lindy Johnson, who was at the time the editor over at Vibe on music. So it was a blowout. Now, over the course of the next 12 years, one thing we stayed really true to was that fact that we were going to continue to community source expertise, because every year we had a failure at the conference. It became the world's largest conference for women in social media. Every year we'd have panels and people would be like, no. No. So every year we would say, all right, we're going to set a key performance indicator. 85% of our speakers will be new every year. We're going to keep the good moderators. They're really hard to find. But 85% will be new, and we're going to set key performance indicators on inclusivity. We don't only want people who look like me or you or her. We're going to be radical and try to stay on the cutting edge of what women are doing with technology. And it was ironically those business metrics and the fairness and transparency with which we invited other people to do it that made a real difference for people who participated.
So. Well, and the reason I asked that question is that when I first started writing and I was education blogging, and I went to my first blogger, and the thing that struck me immediately was the culture was, oh, you're trying this? Let me data dump for you and tell you all the things I did wrong so you won't make the same mistakes. And that was, I was infected with that. And so moving forward, that is how I behave to other writers. So of helping other people deal with that incredibly steep learning curve of becoming a writer or a speaker, whatever that thing is, you clearly from the very beginning said, you know, this is a supportive, inclusive community, and we are going to learn from each other. And that's what makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think one of the things that contributes to that is people failing early. Like, I think if you haven't been humbled early in your career, then you're going to be a terrible boss one day. I had a less than awesome boss. You heard Adam Grant this morning talk about a narcissist. Anybody ever worked for one of those?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I worked for a sociopathic narcissist. And and what you learn, she was fairly young for her role. And as a result, she had never failed. Mm-hmm. She'd never experienced failure. So now she's got so many eyeballs on the work that she's doing that she pushes that risk down into the organization because it takes the failure risk off of her.
Totally.
And she has a place to vent her frustrations. Mm-hmm. And I worked very, very closely with her. And it was a struggle because not only do... And so she became a terrible leader. High, powerful, whatever, but a terrible leader because I didn't have permission to fail. And if I don't have permission to fail, then guess what? When I become a leader, I have no forgiveness. I have no patience. I have no sort of humility with which to let my team fail. And I think that's why it's so important that we fail early so that when you go up, you have a lot of empathy for the team that works for you. And I struggled with her. And I'll tell you what happened there is I personalized so much. Again, what you said earlier about like we can't compartmentalize failure, personal versus professional, or specific project versus ourselves. And so I personalized a lot of it. And the challenge there was that it tortured me emotionally. I went home every day. It was almost like a toxic relationship. Has anybody ever been in one? Somebody treats you like crap, and that's who you are, mm-hmm. right? If they build you up one day, that's who you are. And they basically validate you, your awesomeness or your patheticness every day. But they dictate your self-esteem. And for that, it was such a challenge. And I'll tell you, the only way that I came out of that was finally after about 6 months, I pulled her into a conference room, and I said, I am really good at my job. I am really smart. I am really, really competent, but my confidence has taken a kick because of you. And I walk in every day at my full, like, 5'3", all 5'3 of me. But I crawl out of here like an inch off of the ground because you kick the shit out of me all day long. And this is not doing any good for anybody. You're not getting good work out of me because I am I'm pulling back. Like, I'm crawling under my desk because I don't want to get screamed at. And so as a result, you're not getting good work, and no one's benefiting from my role here. And she stopped, and I don't know that anyone had ever spoken to her like that. And she stopped, and she was like, you're right. I'll back off. And she did. And for about the next 6 months, till she forgot about the conversation and turned psycho again, but for about the next 6 months, it was glorious. And I had freedom, and I felt empowered, and my work soared because I felt... The confidence came back, right? They always say that, like, competence without confidence is just debilitating, but competence without confidence is, confidence without competence is just destructive. Right. And so the combination of the two is so, so critical. But like I said, to tie it back to this, I mean, you really have to have failed early, had your own humility along the way, been humbled, in order to be able to extend that empathy to your team later on. So I encourage you, fail while it doesn't matter.
So there's a theme here about starting over. When I was reading, first learning about all of you and this theme sort of came up early. So, and I think you've done such a huge amount of, you know, taking the wreckage, again, I keep coming back to this metaphor because I just love it. Actually, I think it's Tim Harford's metaphor, but taking what needs to be left behind and moving forward, and you've done so much of it. I would love to know sort of how you're able to get into the headspace and deal with the fear, because I think fear is such a huge part of what holds us back from trying the next thing. How do you manage fear when it comes to having to start over?
And listen, we all have fear, even though people often say to me, because I'm a very, like, outwardly confident-looking person, it looks so easy for you, it doesn't mean that you don't go through all of those same emotions of fear. But I think I've just written a book called Extreme You, and it's all about, I basically interviewed 25 of the most extraordinarily successful people I had come across in my life, from Condoleezza Rice to Bodie Miller, the skier, to Sam Cass, the White House chef, like across all sorts of walks of life. And what I learned from all of them was the single difference between reaching your own potential or sort of staying in the middle ground and just going along is a willingness to overcome that fear, because you know if you succeed, that's great. And if you fail, that's also great, because both things are teaching you. Whereas if you don't even try, you don't get the learnings at all. And I think that, bar none, is what sets these people apart. And
it feels to me like, how do you overcome that fear? Like, one of the tricks I actually personally use a lot is the, what's the worst that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? Like, when I was in my late 30s, I was leading the turnaround of Gatorade, which was a $5 billion business, losing $500 million off its top line in 1 year, which is not fun. Lots of press had a lot to say about that. But honestly, I would do, like, what's the worst that can happen? They can fire me. What's the worst that will happen? I'll get another job. What's the worst that will happen? I'll lose my green card. Well, you know, you just keep going, and you go, at the end of the day, I'll go back to the land of the sheep. I'll be okay. You know, like, but what is that for you? You know, and most often, we make up the end of that story. We take it such a long way, and there's no way that's how it's going to play out. So it's almost like get through that and then say, okay, I've parked that. Now I'm going to move on. And I'm going to own the consequences of what happened. That's what your boss didn't do. Like, if you get out there and take a big bet, you have to be willing to own the consequences, even when they're embarrassing and humiliating. But by doing that, you're going to grow.
I think that is a really inspiring message, Sarah. And I would add, why in the world would you allow you to be your own biggest obstacle?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's how I would really boil down what came through to me from my baby brother's advice. I was actually my own biggest obstacle. There's a fantastic PDF on the Elevest.com site, where I'm chief marketing officer now, that our CEO, Sally Krawchuk, wrote. And she knows a little something about failure and winning, right? The leading woman on Wall Street. And it's called Mind the Gap. It talks about all kinds of different money gaps, performance gaps, investing gaps. There are so many external forces when you're a professional woman that are going to force you into a position where you are literally going to be kept down. You're going to hit your head so hard on that ceiling, right? And no one's going to help you. But there are plenty of others where we have to help ourselves, whether it's making sure that you put enough money away for retirement because we are not being paid the same and we are living longer and we are not investing, or figuring out how you're gonna force yourself into a confident mindset because no one else should be keeping you down. Don't wait until you're my age to figure that out.
Well, and that's the other thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about was the money question. So one of the things, I host a podcast with my former New York Times editor, and we took an inspiration from a book called Scratch, that's fantastic, and it's about scratching out a living as a writer, what the finances actually look like, because it's so bad, if I were to tell you some, you know, some of the numbers, they're really scary and terrible. And so it inspired us to start talking really frankly about the working life of a writer and admitting to, number one, our privilege that we are financed because we have a working spouse. But talking about, like, what we get paid when we write one article for the New York Times, or what we get paid. And that information is power for other people. So keeping, you know, and I understand there are things out there that are personal that you don't want to talk about, but what I have found is that talking about this stuff and opening up to other people about the struggles you're having generally will bring back positive, let me help you with that, let me talk you through that. Oh, I know someone, especially as I mentioned before, at places like, for example, the culture you created at BlogHer. So how do you create that culture of being helpful to one another? Clearly your boss, not so much doing that. But in organizations, we do need to create a culture of let me help you so that you don't make the same mistakes. And how do we go about doing that? Or how do we go about, and also for the people who are trying to find that in their leader, in their leaderships, how do we get that in a workspace?
I actually think that one of the things you're tapping into, which I do think is, I don't have statistics on it, but my gut tells me it's harder for women, is actually being vulnerable in front of others in terms of saying the things that didn't go right. Because I do think as women, well, so I'm 45, so when I came into the workplace, like, we were conditioned to man up, you know, like, don't ever show a weakness. I can literally remember being told, don't ever admit to a weakness in an interview, like, ever, ever. Yet, here's the thing that you learn the further up you go, is when you actually say to someone, I can remember my first role when I was, you know, president, CEO level, running a full P&L, and I suck at finance, and I always have done. And I remember saying, like, to my CFO, who's a man, who's significantly older than me, this is hard for me. And I closed the door and said, this is not a strength, and I'm just going to tell you that right now. And I remember sitting there shaking, thinking, this guy's going to go, why the hell am I reporting to her? the total opposite happened. Like, suddenly he is bought into helping me be successful. And the number of times he would see me in a meeting, he would give me a look as if I'm going to explain that to you afterwards, right? But you feel so nervous to make that move. But I would say, like, try it, because you'll be amazed how you suddenly, like, go from being the person that your boss was, where everyone's like, whatever, you know, don't want to deal with her, to someone that people do want to help. Mm-hmm. So I would highly
absolutely suggest that. That's great advice.
I think a piece too that that's really critical, following sort of a setback or a failure, relevant to that point, kind of figuring out and being willing to admit those vulnerabilities, is there's a time of introspection that's really necessary. That when you come out of it, I mean, when I came off of that role with that boss, I truly believe I had PTSD, similar to you. I mean, I really, like, I'd hear her name, I'd sort of shudder, you know, kind of got that, like, it lasted about a year. But what it was I couldn't remember who I was. I couldn't remember what kind of leader I was. I had sort of married up my style to her in such an unhealthy way that I had to relearn, like, wait, is that the leader I want to be? Like, do I really think, like, do I really feel that I need to completely compartmentalize my life and take all personal relationships out of the table, you know, tell my team I don't want another kid's names because I can't fire them if I know them. Just some of the feedback I got from my old boss. So I couldn't really struggle. So I spent, like, the next 6 months.
Really? Sorry, that just processed that.
Yeah, I got to check your personal life at your door. At the door. I don't care about your kids' names because it's a lot harder to fire you if I know them. Side point. But when I came in, I went through about 6 months of really, like, investing in myself. Like, investing in kind of, like, my job, my next job, fortunately, was so great at kind of putting resources around me, training, leadership, Myers-Briggs, strength training, I mean, you name it, for me to kind of rebuild and recraft my mission statement, recraft who I was, recraft my my leadership style, who I wanted to be, what I wanted to be remembered as, that there is overlap between my personal and professional life, and that's okay, and really opening that up. But it took a long time to get there. So I think the way that you get to that sort of vulnerable stage is really like saying, okay, like, I know what happened, I can block it off as the past. What did I learn from it? How do I want to be different moving forward? So these failures are all part of our story. You have to embrace that whole story, the wins, the losses, all of it, because, man, that's how we, you know, that's where our authentic self kind of comes from.
I really respect you both so much, and I have to disagree with both of you. And then I'm handing it over to my dear Michelle here. But I'm just gonna say this. I think that the in a bullying culture, mm-hmm. and or in a scenario where you are the youngest person and or the brownest person, mm-hmm. and or the most different person, the more strength and confidence you bring, mm-hmm. and the less vulnerability you bring might be the superpower there. Mm-hmm. I just want to offer up those dynamics. Yeah. I just think that it's very individual, and I see everything, you know, socioeconomic differences mm-hmm. of race and everything else, they really play out very differently in cultures. But if you're in a toxic culture, don't stay. Back to you, Michelle.
That's a wrap.
Back to Michelle.
What an awesome panel. Yes? Woo! I so appreciate the vulnerability, the candor. This was just really great discussion. And what we want to do is we have under 10 minutes, but want to open it up for Q&A. So if you have any questions on either side the aisles, you'll see microphones. So feel free to come up immediately and ask one concise question. Okay, and I did have some questions for our panelists, but I want to allow you an opportunity. Please ask your question.
First of all, thank you all for coming up and speaking to us today. Jessica, I wanted to ask you specifically, and anyone else who wants to answer, but you talked a little bit about your story where you had received, like, positive criticism in writing your book. So how do we, or what strategies did you use to help yourself figure out the things that you needed to be listening to in that criticism versus sort of going forward with the things that you believe are truly part of who you are and what you wanted to bring forward?
Thank you for that. That's a really important question. So the nice thing about this situation was that we were talking about a book. And yes, it was very much my own personal story, but most of what, she's a really good editor, and most of what she was giving me was, organize this differently. You know, it was very sort of over there kind of feedback. At the same time, all of it could be categorized. The processing time is so important because when you have this full notebook full of all the different things you did wrong, now here, go deal with it. I had to actually go through and read it multiple times and sort of categorize it. Okay, so what's about organization? What's about a big chunk of it was that I wasn't owning my own expertise. I mean, picture the situation. I had been teaching middle school and high school, and suddenly I'm writing a book where I am an expert on resilience and failure. Well, by the time, you know, I had done the research and I had done all that stuff, I was becoming that. But the biggest mistake I made was not owning my expertise. I overquoted other people because I was like, look, I'm going to say this thing, but look, all these people back me up. Here are all the people who think I could be right. So that that was a really important piece of feedback. In fact, now when people are writing nonfiction and are asking for guidance from me, that is the biggest thing I tell them. Find a few books to keep on your desk of people who own their expertise in a big-ass way. And then pick the, every time you're feeling, you know, like you're really not there, pick it up and look at it. There's some great ones, Peggy Ornstein's Girls and Sex, this book by Vicki Hofla called Duct Tape Parenting. She just is not afraid to say these things and put it out there and say, look, you're not going to agree with some of that, but that is okay because this book is me. And finding those voices, and they don't necessarily have to be writers, but finding those voices for me was one of the most important things I did. All the rest I was able to put over there, but owning my expertise was a personal struggle that I had to deal with. And it's taken me, you know, it's taken me a while to sort of say, oh my gosh, I never classify myself as an expert because I just basically think that's blowing smoke up people's ass. But I do have to say, you know, no, I know the research on this. There isn't anyone better for, you know, to be standing here talking about this stuff. So learning that was really the hardest part because that was about believing in myself. And thank you for asking the question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, no other questions. So I have my own. So speed round. Less than. Did you have a question? Come. So while you're coming, let me ask this one question. Speed round, less than 1 minute answer, and give a strategy to our family out here on how to overcome this. You talked about public speaking, right, being a huge fear, and that's probably true for many people in the audience. Even Bill Clinton said he still gets nervous before a speech. Mm-hmm. So if he gets nervous, we have the right as well, right? what was that thing or those things you did to overcome your fear of public speaking?
I had to practice relentlessly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Anytime there was an opportunity to speak, I started speaking up more in team meetings where I wasn't the leader. I started forcing myself to stand up in front of my own team. Mm-hmm. I put myself in a position where I had to give presentations. Mm-hmm. And I also started writing more publicly. This was sort of pre-blogging. This was back in the late 90s.
Good.
Yeah.
Doing it is what it is.
The work. Yeah. Right.
Agony.
Yes.
That was my question, actually.
We knew that. Okay. We knew that.
But yeah, I was just wondering how you overcame that because, listening, I mean, you've obviously done it.
Thank you.
So I just was wondering how you did that, but you answered it. Thank you.
Actually, I want to add to that. One of my best friends not only was afraid of public speaking, but had that situation where she had that vagal nerve thing. So the red would climb up above her chest and up here, and it would spread. And she would, every time she stood up in court, that would happen. Mm-hmm. And the only way she got better at that was by going into empty courtrooms. She had her friends come and do it. She practiced over and over and over and over until it became a routine for her, and it was no longer something that activated her sympathetic nervous system and into overdrive. Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I don't really have a question so much as I have a statement. So what does failure look like to women? And it can be something as very simple as they don't think I did a good job or just they don't like me. Mm-hmm. And so women internalize that all day long. I mean, that's from talking to the women that I work with, et cetera. So it isn't just I didn't get the job or I lost the job. It's these little all day long failures that we kind of internalize. So I was just kind of curious for you guys. I mean, you've seemed to move up. You had the narcissistic boss that just kind of pushed all that aside. Yep. So how do you find that balance between, no, that wasn't a failure, I'm okay, and moving forward?
Sarah, can you take that?
Yeah, I mean, because I do think you have to do, there's something to be said for owning your part in things that go wrong, so which your boss clearly didn't, because if you're not, then you're not learning from it. And so I think some of that actually can be the openness of asking for feedback, by the way, from, it doesn't have to be your boss, people that work for you can give you some of the most enlightening feedback of all time. But I do think in the end, you have to stop, and particularly for women, stop worrying about what do they think I just did. What did I think I just did? And one of the greatest people I interviewed in my book, Bodie Miller, the skier, he explained to me how he used to think about this idea of subjective goals instead of objective goals. He's like, just because the American media said I was going to win 7 medals at Torino, that wasn't my goal. My goal is XYZ. And so think to yourself, like, what did I set out to accomplish today? What did I say I was going to do? And if I did that, that's a success. If someone else thinks I failed, that's their problem.
Yeah. One other thing I'll say on that is, I know we're just about done, is we are highly critical of ourselves. We are not as much of other women, or, you know, like we can see it. So surround yourself by strong women that can speak truth to you. Like your own, you're going to manipulate it in your own head to sort of like pull you down, but your women friends are going to build you up. So surround yourself with strong women, like these two ladies right here.
And one of the strongest women I know is about to ask a question.
Oh, good. Yes, our final question.
Hi, guys. Thank you for a great panel. My name is Jackie Huber, by the way. Lisa Stone is one of my personal heroes. And what I've not got to ask you, Lisa, just being involved with building this amazing organization called Blog Her and your heart and soul into it, and then leaving that... And it seemed like you took a while to move into this next thing. And I'm just wondering if you have any advice for any of us who are looking for that next adventure and then giving up something that you love so much. What's the like one piece of advice you would give people?
I do. Thank you. I have two pieces of advice. The first is you need to read Jackie Huber's books. Okay, this woman right here is a pioneer. She wrote two books that are brilliant, Monster Loyalty, which is about the story of Lady Gaga's ride to fame and fortune in social media. But tell them about your second book just really quick.
It's called Fiercely You, Be Fabulous and Confident by Thinking Like a Drag Queen. By using their fierce role models, and they've taught us a lot about how to be as fierce as we can possibly be.
Yeah. You should see her transformation. This book is unreal. Here's how I transformed myself from a successful CEO and entrepreneur who had raised $20 million in venture capital and then another $130 million in sponsorship to help pay women more than $36 million as writers and photographers. So when you take venture capital, you agree to have an exit for the company, right? Mm. No choice. So ultimately, we knew we were not an IPO-able company. We were about a $30 million laboratory for social media. Our biggest advertisers spent about $2 to $5 billion on Facebook and social media based on what they learned from us. It was great. We met our mission to pay women to write. So we had our exit. I successfully did the merger with She Knows Media, forming the number one women's lifestyle network. Finally, number one.
Yes.
And then I handed over the reins to my baby, to a man, Philippe Galtan, the CEO of She Knows Media. And I had to stay there for a year. That was part of the deal. And then I had to leave and sort of be non-competitive for a year. And a couple of things happened. First of all, my kids were like, do not make me your project. Okay.
Don't
back
do
away.
That.
But the other thing was that I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what would Lisa Stone be if Blog Her hadn't happened. Like, what would I care about? What would I do? I did a ton of writing. I wrote every morning. I did a ton of working out. I ended up taking much better care of myself. I ended up having some really critical and important arguments with my partner, Christopher Carfi, about our life together and where we want to go. And ultimately, then the election happened. And I thought I was going to be deep in a big tech company building software for the rest of my life, because that was something I wanted to do more. And then when President 45 came into power and we started hearing bad news from DC and Hollywood and Silicon Valley about the way women are being treated, I was like, that's it. I'm in it to win it. I'm going back to the chick trough. And so I joined LFS. But I really, through that process, I really was like, wow, am I a CEO first, or am I just Lisa Stone who happened to do that? And I would say I found it was the latter.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Yes, Jessica and Sarah.
Books after this.
Jessica and Sarah will be signing books in the bookstore immediately following. Have
Great
a
job.
Wonderful remainder job, of the conference. Thank you.